Hello, today we're speaking with Hunter McDaniel, founder and CEO of Ubiquity. Welcome to the podcast, Hunter.
Thanks, James. Happy to be here.
Very good. To start, could you tell us a little bit about Ubiquity?
Sure. So we're a deep tech advanced materials company spin off from Los Alamos National Laboratory. We're also licensing some technology exclusively from MIT, University of Washington, and Western Washington. And we've pulled in some team members from those institutions. So you can kind of argue we're a spinoff from several. But really, our purpose is about leveraging nanomaterials to make lasting positive impacts on society. And as a team, we're most passionate about trying to address issues related to climate change. And the core technology is a material that's effective at manipulating light. You can change one color of light into another, very high efficiency, which makes it a platform. But primarily, we're focused on deploying that into the facades of buildings, essentially to make the building more efficient, leveraging the power that's coming from the sun.
And I guess whenever I talk to people who are working at like real kind of frontier tech and moving that into kind of commercialization, there's often a kind of a question around timing. Is like, when is the good time to take something that's like this remarkable step change in technology and bring it to, you know, the masses, as it were? If you think back to the kind of founding story of Ubiquity, like how did you kind of think through that process when you're like, okay, we have something really exciting here that could potentially build a company around?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I was a postdoc at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I completed my PhD at University of Illinois and then had an opportunity to come to Los Alamos in the chemistry division. And there were a couple kind of aha moments in the lab where I recall looking at the data coming from one spectrometer, just being shocked by how bright the material was, how efficiently it was emitting light in the infrared part of the spectrum, near infrared part of the spectrum. And so that was just kind of from a technical perspective, I felt like there was a breakthrough there. You know, I had a foundation in material science engineering and felt like I knew what I was looking at. And there was kind of an aha moment there, but it wasn't really, I didn't appreciate it, how much work would be required from that point to take that material, that an invention, if you will, into commercial products, and sort of figured that out the hard way in the school of hard knocks. After starting the company in 2014, just kind of like spending a lot of time out there in the marketplace trying to understand what the market needed and how we could provide solutions and, you know, so-called customer discovery type activities. Read a lot of books, talked to a lot of smart people. As far as getting at this directly to your question, when is the right time? You know, I think Peter Thiel has said a lot of smart things over the years, and he's indirectly an investor in our company. And one of the things that he told me when I met with him some years ago was, and I think this might be in his book, Zero to One, something along these lines, you don't want to be the first mover in a space. It's too much heavy lifting, too much sort of plowing the field, which can be just long and arduous and expensive. You really want to be the last great advancement in a field. And so I think we kind of embody that with respect to quantum dots. There's been a lot of hard work in terms of validating that quantum dots can be useful in products. And the first startups were all created back in the early 2000s, raised a lot of money, spent a lot of years trying to figure out what the first product would be. Clearly, this technology, this material is very interesting and useful for something, but it took them a long time to get to the point, maybe, you know, arguably about 14 years before the first real commercial products came out with the Sony line of televisions and then the Amazon Kindle Fire tablet in displays. But those materials had some fundamental issues that were limiting them from going bigger and beyond the display space. And I feel like that's what we stumbled upon when, you know, in that lab in Los Alamos, was kind of the next iteration of quantum dots that now enabled them to go big, where we could leverage all of the hard work that had been done. The methods of manufacturing, the analytical technique, processing, just understanding these materials took a long time, both in academia and in the industrial sector. And we had kind of come across sort of the final big advancement that was needed to then take quantum dots to the, you know, broadly speaking, to all these other applications. And that was the idea behind the company. Ubiquity is short for ubiquitous quantum dots, with the idea that now quantum dots can become ubiquitous now that we've resolved these toxicity, cost, and reliability issues, kind of with one fell swoop with this new composition.
Yeah, I guess just, I suppose, a general question then about quantum dots and kind of nanomaterials more generally. First, I'd love to kind of just get a bit more of an understanding around the how these are created, maybe both at the lab level and then later at kind of a scalable level. And then also, when these kind of materials are created, they obviously have these kind of phenomenally kind of fascinating properties. But were these properties being sought for, and this was like one mechanism to figure out how to display these type of properties? Or, which sounds like in the case of your particular company, it was kind of surprising that there was these properties that were emergent from these types of quantum dots.
Well, in the early days, it was more of a physics experiment. Folks were seeing that there were different colors from the same composition of matter, and that was kind of novel. In the past, if you wanted to make a new color of material, either absorptive, which would be like what we call a pigment, or fluorescent, you would need to make a new composition, a new dye molecule or a new phosphor composition, etc. But with quantum dots, it was kind of discovered that you could tune the color by the size, and it's actually a quantum mechanical effect. You know, just to go back to the basics there, when you confine an electron, when you squeeze it, you can change the energy states. And so when you make a particle small enough, you're basically confining the electron, and you shift those energy levels, and so you control the colors basically that way. And so for a long time, and you know, 40 years ago, it was more of like a physics thing, like we're uncovering some quantum mechanics here, some interesting properties of materials, and then can we control it? And over time, it evolved into, well, yeah, maybe we can actually make these from the ground up. And there were some big advancements from Paul Basadas, Munji Bawindi in those early days. Those are two kind of famous professors in the field, where they were controlling in a liquid reaction the size of these particles from the ground, from the bottom up. So you start with precursors that nucleate in solution, form clusters of atoms, and then those clusters begin to grow. And as long as you can control that nucleation moment so that it is sort of arrested, it happens over a short period of time, then all the particles will have roughly the same size, because we're all created at the same moment, and then they grew roughly at the same rate. And then you can sort of stop it when you get to the size of particles that you want. At least that's the most rudimentary sort of approach to doing it. And it became clear that this could be very useful, just to be able to make any arbitrary color with very high precision. And this is kind of what I mean about leveraging the past. Many, many years, thousands and thousands of papers have been published, probably more than that, maybe 100,000 papers have been published on how to make these particles and different techniques, but tuning the reaction kinetics and the precursors and the temperature and all these things to really precisely control the size of the particles. And then, you know, along the way, all sorts of applications were envisioned, and, you know, some patents were filed, a lot of papers were published on different cool things you could do with quantum dots. But it took a lot longer than I think everyone expected to actually translate that into commercial success. And the success was somewhat limited in terms of there's really only one, maybe a couple tangent markets around, you know, that prior to Ubiquity that were actually getting traction in the market related to displays, display and lighting, I guess, just making a very accurate light source. And that can be used in the back of a display to make a very color accurate, more efficient display. If you just have to use basically, you only need to use a blue LED at that point, because you can use quantum dots to convert the blue into very pure red and green. And then in lighting, those are primarily red quantum dots, but you can sort of dabble in some red quantum dots into a traditional white LED, and you can make it a warmer spectrum, relatively high efficiency, because you can sort of add in the red without compromising light that you can't see. Normally, phosphors would be very broad emitting, and they'd emit a bunch of light that you can't actually see by eye. And so that's a loss mechanism. But with quantum dots, you can very precisely dial in those colors. But those are the markets that have been successful so far. I mean, there's quite a bit of product on the market for in the display space in particular. But people have talked about using quantum dots for sunscreen and therapeutics and diagnostics and solar and, you know, really any application involving light. There's probably a way you can use quantum dots to make it more efficient. But those just didn't quite make it. And our argument, the thesis was, it was really the toxicity of those compounds, traditionally cadmium-based. Those early quantum dots are all cadmium selenide or cadmium sulfide. But then also the cost. It's very difficult to control that nucleation step. So you couldn't for a long time make very large reactors. You'd have to mix together two things very fast. And so there's another company that ultimately got bought by Samsung called QD Vision out of MIT that was founded around that time in the early 2000s. And they, as far as I know, hadn't scaled beyond 5-liter reactors, but they had to run those in parallel, and they were supplying quantum dots to Sony for TVs using 5-liter, it's pretty small reactors, just because of this mixing issue. So with our technology, we don't have to mix things together at high temperature rapidly. We just basically heat up and mix, and then we don't have any of those toxic heavy metals present. We get kind of lucky with some of the other properties that were emergent. That aha moment was just seeing how bright it was, just that it was saturating this detector in the lab. And it was kind of like, wow, that's way brighter than anything else that we've ever looked at before by order of magnitude. So something special must be going on here. It's not even fully optimized or anything. It's super bright.
And then with kind of then trying to bring that to the sustainability lens, right? And I would love to kind of get into the couple of applications that you're kind of developing right now. So one is around windows, I believe, and glazing. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, this is something that I've been working on longer than sort of our first market, which is in agriculture. I can tell you that in a minute. But this material has some properties that are very well aligned with what's called a luminescent solar concentrator, kind of similar to quantum dots, a technology that's been around a long time, was first envisioned back in the 70s. And the idea was that solar cells were, at that time, very, very expensive. Maybe what we can do is make a fluorescent panel that's glowing in the sun, and then that glow can harvest light. Basically, it could harvest light over a large area, like a window, but it didn't necessarily have to be a window. It'd be just a way of lowering the cost, basically, by collecting light over energy over a large area with a fluorescent material, and then that fluorescent, would get guided to the edges of this waveguide where you put solar cells. So you could basically use very small amount of actual photovoltaic material to harvest light over a large area. That was originally about just lowering the cost of solar. But none of the materials that were fluorescent at the time, and even many subsequent years where people were trying to develop this further, were adequate for doing this. Either the dyes would degrade in the sun, they wouldn't hold up long enough, or they have this issue where they would absorb their own luminescence. So it's kind of a deeper topic, but the absorption of the material and the emission of the material overlapped very strongly, which didn't really matter in other applications, but if you're trying to propagate the luminescence through a large distance through the same material, it gets reabsorbed and it's a loss mechanism. So you couldn't really scale it. And then this material that we're working with, called copper indium disulfide primarily, and some related compounds, has this property where it doesn't have much, if really any, overlap between its absorption and emission. So you could really propagate the light through a long distance. It is an actual crystalline material. It's an inorganic material, so it's much more stable in the sun. And then we can tune the color into kind of the sweet spot, which is where it absorbs over the whole, most of the visible spectrum, and then emits light in the near infrared. And that's what I was describing on this detector, this light emission. So that makes it very efficient for harvesting sunlight, basically, and then scaling it to a large area. And then you check these boxes around the toxicity and the cost, which are going to be critical for any energy application. And pretty quickly, you're like, oh, wow, this is like all these sort of critical properties are converging together around this use case in what's called a luminescent solar concentrator. Like I said, you don't have to use it as a window, but one of the most interesting properties of this is that it's partially transparent. You can sort of make it darker if you put more quantum dots there, but you can make it lighter, just like any other window tint would look. And then that really enables you to harvest sunlight from glass, from windows. And that's probably the biggest market that we're pursuing. It's a difficult product. It's a difficult market when your value proposition is primarily around energy. But it has the potential to really solve climate change. If we can convert all this glass, which is ubiquitous around Austin right now, and glass everywhere, and if we can convert that into energy generators at a low enough cost with a high enough efficiency, then we can make these buildings no longer loads on the grid, but assets for the grid. They could provide their own power, but then even maybe power the buildings nearby if everything worked out just right. And that's the vision. It's about reducing the carbon footprint of buildings.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think I talked recently to somebody who works on kind of speculative fiction and solar punk concepts in his writing. And we were kind of talking about how there's kind of a bit of a lack of very big vision storytelling within the kind of climate tech space, right? Like a lot of it is the current world with a few more windmills or whatever it may be. But I think one of the fascinating things with like the advances in material science in particular is being able to actually change the built environment in these kind of completely unique ways so that rather than buildings being independent structures that aren't really doing anything to the world around it, but moving it into something that's more dynamic, that is generating an energy or is maybe a store of energy for the grid at various times as we kind of have more ubiquitous like battery storage as well. And so I like, you know, the ability to kind of reimagine the built environment in these ways where the materials of the environment themselves become this dynamic thing. Carbon capturing concrete is another example, right? I think is incredibly exciting. And so as you're trying to bring that vision to those, you know, these massive realtors or the construction industry who are, you know, have done things in a certain way for, probably for quite a long time, how do you kind of, I guess, translate that vision into something that is like, okay, this is an investment we may want to make?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It is tough. Built environment is an old industry, a slow-moving industry, very risk-averse industry. And windows in particular are kind of a sore subject because they're one of the biggest loss mechanisms for buildings, just compared to the wall, in a better order of magnitude, less efficient at keeping the heat in or the heat out, however you want to think about it, whatever's needed. And, you know, at the same time, we're naturally outdoor creatures. And so we want to engage with the outside. We want to have the view. We want to bring in natural daylight. So we obviously value windows, and increasingly the window to wall ratio is large, especially in urban areas. So it's kind of about, you know, approaching the industry with a little bit of a level head about what is setting some expectations that this isn't going to happen overnight, but trying to demonstrate what's possible and help the industry rethink what windows are about. They can be not just the problem, but actually part of the solution. And the window can be a central point. Our first product in this area is basically a retrofit smart window that is bringing, you know, we provide the platform for that with a power supply. But then there's all sorts of smart functionality that you can embed into the window, sensors and automated blinds that could be tied to the HVAC systems, and actually being able to sort of be engaged with the guest or the tenant of the building in a way that wasn't really, people didn't think of that before. But there's all sorts of sort of old technologies there at the window. Like still most blinds are you have to go up and manually pull a chain, which is crazy. We have the technology to put a little motor in there. It's very easy. Like, why aren't there buttons that open and close the blind? I mean, it exists, but very little market penetration of that kind of product. Although there are some examples of hope where double pane windows, for example, are introduced in the 70s and became roughly 70-80% market share within 20 years. There's some coatings now on the glass, low emissivity coatings that are useful for energy efficiency, that were rapidly adopted in the 80s and 90s and now have similar market share, something like 70-80% of commercial buildings. So it can happen, but you've got to have a very simple, cost-effective solution, and you've got to be engaged with the industry. Don't try to disrupt the industry. I mean, I think disruption is a little bit overrated. You know, it depends on what you mean when you say it, but I think we should be leveraging the existing channels to market, manufacturing processes, and work together with the market leaders today in the built environment.
I mean, if you're already disrupting like the very material that the product is made out of, also disrupting supply lines and all those other things is biting off. Exactly. And it actually also even fascinates me, startups who are like, we're also going to disrupt the nature of hierarchical organizations at the same time we're trying to build a company. It's like so much disruption you can do, right? Like you have to kind of lean on the tools you have wherever possible. You also mentioned this other application that sounds like it's been going on for a little bit longer within agriculture. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it was really something that came out of customer discovery that we were doing for windows. This goes back to maybe 2016, 2017, where the story around windows was powering skyscrapers with glass, a big vision. But it's pretty obvious that a small 10-person startup, 5-person startup with very limited funding in those early days wasn't going to start installing windows on skyscrapers as the first market. And so we embarked on some pretty aggressive customer discovery to find beachhead market, early adopter market that we could start on, focus on initially. And greenhouses came up as a possibility. There's others, you know, automotive was another one that people often bring up. You know, what about solar windows for cars? And we looked at a number of different markets and talked to people in the value chain, various stakeholders. And with the greenhouse one, when we talked to the growers, there's definitely interest in a solar glass product. I mean, obviously greenhouse has often have a lot of glass. We didn't realize at the time that most greenhouses actually had plastic film roofs, but you think of this glass house when I say the word greenhouse, you're probably imagining like something you'd find up in the Netherlands or Canada And so there's a lot of glass, and energy is one of their biggest expenses. And so if you could potentially generate electricity from the glass, well, that could be valuable. But they kept coming back to us with the same question, how is this going to impact my crops? I can't compromise my crop yield at all. That drives everything for us. And so if you've got a solution that will save me on my overhead costs, my electricity costs, but not hurt my crops, then that would be pretty interesting for us. And so we said, well, okay, you know, our bread and butter is being able to tune this stuff. We can make any color we want. Maybe we can make a color of glass that would be sort of not harmful to the crops, let the light that they're effective at using pass through, but then generate electricity. And then there was kind of this more of a commercial aha moment back in those days where we're like, maybe we can just actually provide plants with the better quality of light, period, and forget about electricity generation and get more crop yield, because clearly these guys care a lot about their crop yield. And so that might be a more valuable thing to bring to them than the electricity. So we started doing some very small scale trials. I remember the very first one that we did was like literally a single tomato plant. And we were able to make some very rudimentary films that had quantum dots and sort of surround the plant, put it in a little research greenhouse. And we were shocked. The thing was like twice as big underneath our films, which isn't necessarily how it works today in a commercial setting.
Right.
In a very small scale trial, you can see some big things, especially if it's not optimized. But anyway, that was kind of like maybe there's something here kind of moment. And then we started doing some math on like, okay, well, let's say we could boost the crop yield by 10%. What would that be worth to a grower? And how would that compare to the amount of electricity we can create for them? And actually, it's quite a bit more value that you bring if you can boost the crop yield. And so that began kind of this effort in exploring this market more seriously. And then at almost every turn, we were reinforcing this idea that this could be a better first market for us. We're not going to give up on the windows. And we had some non-dilutive funding from the National Science Foundation. Department of Energy was helping out. We have a grant from Wells Fargo that have been non-dilutively funding the windows, as it is a pretty heavy lift to get there. But the investors were more excited, and we were seeing more near-term opportunity, simpler product, stronger value proposition around just making the quality of light in a greenhouse better. So fast forward to today, we have a product line, a brand called UbiGrow. It has its own website. You can check it out, ubigrow.com. And it's a retrofit film, about 4 foot wide, any arbitrary length, that you hang up in an existing greenhouse. And it essentially makes your roof glow down on the plants. And we can make different colors, but across a range of trials, we found that this orange color was kind of a catch-all. There's definitely a certain spectra that work better in certain situations, certain crops. And that's something that we're studying pretty heavily. We'll be launching a second color here in a couple months. But this first product has been on the market now a couple of years, and we've seen results as high as maybe 30% or so yield improvement for tomatoes. We've looked at cucumbers, lettuce, cannabis, strawberries, some other crops, or at least our partners have. We don't actually do much growing ourselves, obviously, but that has led to this product line that seems to be resonating with the market. And you know, we've got a pipeline of different products, different colors and form factors and things that we're going to bring to the greenhouse industry. And yeah, so far so good. That's just turned out to be a good first market for us.
That's so interesting. I'd imagine it demos pretty well if like the farmer can actually see the sparkle, right? Can actually see that improvement. I've mentioned on the podcast before, I grew up on a farm in the west coast of Ireland. And I would say that conservative in terms of the adoption of new practices is at the minimum, you could say, of how people kind of respond. And we converted to organic in, I think it was 1997. And that was like madness, right? By like the other farmers in our area. And so as you're kind of going to different growers, like how are they kind of understanding the process? I guess a similar question to when we were talking about the buildings before. I guess because they are having a more immediate, direct feedback, are they kind of a bit more kind of open to it relative to building owners and the like?
Yeah, I mean, both markets are fairly risk averse. There's a saying, don't bet the farm, for a reason. Sure. The farmers understand that they have boom and bust cycles, crop prices or drought and whatnot can drive things in wild directions. And so they're very, very conservative often in terms of making changes. And they all feel like they have sort of the secret sauce, special approach, a unique approach. And so when you go to a grower, particularly the larger ones, they often will like want to see the results for themselves. They want to do a test or a trial, a pilot. And we don't necessarily subsidize those, but we can sometimes do discounts. But the takeaway would be that they will not go fully all in on their entire farm in most cases. We have had a couple do that, but it's more of an exception to the rule. And I heard one investor say that they've seen this in the farming industry as well, where they'll start with 1% of their acreage testing something out, and then they'll go to 10% if that looks good, and then they'll go to 100%. So we've definitely seen that, and plants unfortunately grow slow. You know, I come from the material science space where you make a material, you can just go in the lab and take a measurement and you get the answer. Like it worked, it didn't, what the efficiency was. But with plants, they're can be pretty fickle. There's a lot of inputs and things you have to make sure you water them. If you don't water them, then you're not going to get any useful data. And if something goes wrong with your irrigation system, well, you know, throw out that data set. And in commercial settings, it depends on the crop, but the cycles can be very long. For tomatoes, it, you know, basically runs the full year when they will cut, chop it down and do a new crop. Lettuce would be much faster, some number of weeks, you know, a month or so to get a cycle on lettuce, depending on the variety. But yeah, so they want to see those results for themselves. It certainly helps to just simply see the material, see it glowing in the sun. You really kind of get it at that point where you're like, oh, okay, so it's actually converting light. A lot of times people think that this is like a filter, and they ask, why do I need quantum dots? I could just put some sort of orange colored plastic up above my plants. But once you see it, you can really, this, it looks different. There's like a sheen to it, like an orange kind of glow to the product. And that does resonate with the growers. And depending on who you're talking to, that can, you know, be communicated different ways. Growers typically will see the best yields in the Northern Hemisphere in the late summer. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the sun sits lower in the sky is kind of a hand-wavy argument in the late summer, and you get more of a red-orange spectrum, kind of like the sunset is lasting longer. And that can be a triggering mechanism for the plants. The plants have evolved to respond to that because it's telling them that, hey, winter is coming and you better get your reproduction going, and in other words, produce fruit. So we're kind of gaming that evolution of the plant a little bit. So that those growers that are growing outside are using natural light, well, it'll resonate with them to talk about this is sort of mimicking the late summer sun year round. For growers that were growing indoor before and they're moving into greenhouses, which is becoming common with electricity prices being high and competition, especially in the cannabis space, you can sort of talk about the lighting and how this is a way of making a similar spectrum than you would make if you could design it from the ground up lighting, in particular, what's called high-pressure sodium lamps, like your street lamps, they have this orange color. Those are very common in indoor agriculture. And that same sort of color looks very similar to the film, this orange glow. But you're getting that without having to use any electricity or buy those lamps.
That's super interesting. And you know, I guess if we kind of look out over the next couple of years, like what are some of the kind of milestones you're hoping to reach in that kind of time frame?
Yeah, so I mean, with UbiGrow, it's really pedal to the metal. We've got a sales and marketing team. Like to see that double or triple in the next year or so. We've got a new website that we just launched. And so we'll be more aggressive with sort of educating the market that this technology exists. And then we've got some new products coming in that line. I mentioned that we've got another color. It's a little bit deeper red that we've developed over the last couple of years in collaboration with University of Arizona. We've got some other colors that are under development, but probably won't be launched until next year. But then maybe the big moment is launching the next generation of the product, moving towards actually integrating it into the roof of the greenhouse. Right now, as I mentioned, it's a retrofit. You can add it on, which is a great place to start because it's a very low barrier to entry for the grower. They can just sort of go hang it up anywhere, small area or big area of their greenhouse. And then for us, it's very manageable in terms of manufacturing. But then the second generation product is actually integrating the quantum dots into the roofing facade materials, starting with a greenhouse film, polyethylene film, that's made by an extrusion process. So this can actually be up to about 60 foot wide. And that actually gets draped over, and it's lots of different kinds of greenhouses, but think of like a hoop house, like this semicircle sort of shaped structure. And then you have a plastic film that gets draped over the top of that. And so we're aiming to offer an alternative to what's on the market today that it looks very similar, feels very similar, but just has this orange glow to it. So those are the big milestones for UbiGrow, expanding the team, more aggressive on the marketing, and then some product launches. For windows, it's really about getting our first commercial product into the market. We've been doing pilots and installing windows into buildings now for about a year and getting to the point where folks are really demanding this. that they want to buy the product. And you know, we want to make sure that it's ready for that sort of a stage. And it is a manufacturing process that requires a little bit of tweaking, not too different than how you make Windows. In fact, that's one of the big advantages over our competition. But we really need to get our quality control down and the engineering steps in place to have that. It's, you know, it's an electronic product, but we're aiming to have that launched by the end of this year. And it's going to couple the window with a window unit that can be retrofitted into a building with the use case, which is around smart functionality. So there's a printed circuit board that has sensors and controls a motorized blind, and then could be a platform from there to do all sorts of different things.
Very exciting. Having all those kind of different lines kind of going at the same time, definitely exciting, but also, you know, brings its challenges. And you mentioned kind of like expanding out the sales and marketing team. And for, I guess, a company like yours, I would imagine you had a ton of R&D, very technical folk. I'm sure there's a lot of PhDs, especially in the first few years, and maybe not a lot of those other kind of sales and marketing and maybe other functions. What have you kind of learned about building like a high performance team that tries to merge like those different elements in a company that is bringing such a kind of advanced degree of science to market?
Yeah, well, some advice that I've had from several folks over the years was to hire a sales director earlier rather than later, even before you have a product. That person can help guide you or towards something that the market would want to buy, and start doing some preliminary work in terms of sowing the seeds in the marketplace where that the technology is coming. And maybe it's frustrating for a seasoned sales guy because there's not a lot of volume there in terms of selling. So you need the right kind of person for that role. But and maybe it's more business development. If you've got a B2B type of technology, you're not going to be selling directly to an end user. That is something that's a little bit unique in terms of our business model compared to traditional advanced materials companies. We could talk about it in a minute. But yeah, I mean, I think in our case, you really have to get out there and engage with the end user because it's something completely new. We want to understand how it's being used, how it might be used, how it would go up, you know, what kind of just simple things like how do you attach the film to the greenhouse structure? What kind of roofing do they already have? If they have something that's filtering or changing the spectrum, you know, maybe not in the visible, but a lot of roofing materials will remove UV, for example, and we would harvest the UV. So just understanding how the product would be used, what the needs are of the grower, what their growing techniques are, that sort of thing, the sales and marketing team can focus on that part. And I think we're just like any other kind of deep tech sort of company. In the early days, we were all PhDs. I think the first five employees all had PhDs. And I have a PhD, as I mentioned. And so we're thinking about things in terms of the performance and the materials and the chemistry, and less about the product and how to market it and the unit economics and the go-to-market strategy and who the critical stakeholders are in the value chain. So yeah, I had some smart people around me that were pushing me to maybe get out of my comfort zone a little bit in terms of marketing and sales and biz dev in the early days, and that really paid dividends.
Yeah, and you mentioned trying to differentiate a little bit around the business model. How does your business model compare to other similar companies as yourselves?
Yeah, so a traditional advanced material company is seeking to supply an additive into a supply chain. And quantum dots are actually a good example of this. In the early days, and even today, quantum dots are being manufactured and supplied into the display space. And so quantum dot manufacturer, like the leader, Nanosys, doesn't make the TVs. And I don't think they have any intention of making TVs. It would be very challenging to go create a new brand and compete in that space. It's a difficult market. So what do they do? They license their technology to companies like Samsung and supply quantum dots to, you know, downstream partners, not necessarily directly those OEMs, but some of the tier one suppliers to them that supply the components of the TVs to them. So the business model for them is they manufacture quantum dots and then they supply technology, they license technology. And that's very common for advanced materials, very high margin business because you've got that licensing component, but it's limited in terms of your ability to capture value. The value of all those TVs being manufactured and sold each year, something like $10 to $15 billion. But the revenue of the companies that are supplying the dots is significantly less. And the reason is that they're supplying an additive that goes into, you know, supply chain, there's markups. And then ultimately there's value created in the market. You know, they can sell those TVs for some $100 or whatever, hundreds of dollars more than they would otherwise. But the ability of that additive supplier to capture that value is more limited. So we recognized that early on, and that was sort of a concern, and some VCs didn't like it. You know, they want to see more revenue potential, and also the time scale can be longer, right? Because you're relying on these downstream partners to go do something. Hopefully they will get excited. Hopefully they will go fast. Hopefully they will create the brand with quantum dot related brand, like Samsung has QLED and Q stands for quantum dot, but you're just sort of hoping that those things will happen. And we didn't really have the time to wait. And also we were doing something very different than what was existing in the marketplace with the greenhouse film. And so we decided to have those films initially toll manufactured, which is where you pay someone to have the product made. We supply the toll manufacturer with dots, but then we buy the films from them. And so that enabled us to go faster. And then we were able to go directly to the grower from there. So, you know, initially just to get some data, some trials and understand how it would be used. But then we realized, well, why not just flip the switch and start selling to these guys? And so that is our model now. We manufacture the dots. We organize the manufacture of finished products through contract manufacturing, toll manufacturing. In some cases, that maybe looks more like distribution, but we pull it through the supply chain so we don't have to wait. And then we go directly to the end user and sell them the products. So we capture 100% of that revenue on the final sale. And that is much more venture backable type business model because your addressable market is essentially the entire, you know, market at that point, not just the additive. And then we don't have to wait and we don't have to raise a ton of money either, right? Because we're using existing supply chain. We're using existing manufacturing capacity to make the product. That's going pretty well for UbiGrow. And the plan is to replicate that with Windows, even though it's a bit more complicated product and longer supply chain or value chain to get to that finished good. But so far, so good. I guess the initial.
That makes a ton of sense. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that it was a kind of a long journey. There was a lot of ups and downs along the way. I guess when you were kind of hitting into some of those downs, those down periods, you know, when things may not, like, might have seemed like they may not go in the right direction, how did you, I guess, kind of manage yourself in those moments to kind of keep that commitment, keep that inspiration through those tough times?
Well, it does get very, very difficult. You know, you just have to kind of keep reminding yourself of the vision and, you know, what the big goal is. And in our case, it's a very big vision, right? It's around helping humanity avoid extinction, really. And that keeps you going. You know, the vision, you have to really be a true believer and sort of quote unquote drink your own Kool-Aid, if you will, for that to work. But, you know, prioritizing your own family and health. I've got two young kids that are very, very motivational for me and help take me away from the daily grind. Just spending a little bit of time with them is like the best medicine for any kind of a bad day, if you will. But it's tough. You know, there's not really a good answer there. You kind of have to have some grit, roll up your sleeves and be willing to work hard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, having those kind of other support mechanisms, as you said, you know, having family and sometimes even they're not, you're as much their support mechanism. And so, like I said, friend of mine always says happiness is solving problems for other people. And so like if you're doing that kind of constantly, both in the kind of local, within the family unit, within friends and all that kind of thing, and then like also working on these massive problems, I think there's a balance to be had there. And a lot of the people I think who are working on climate from a startup point of view or a company point of view are incredibly excited and have, I think generally like a better life, work-life balance than a lot of other startup founders where it's a bit more of a grind to do the 80 hours with something that might not have as much impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Very good. Hunter, this has been amazing. I really appreciate the time. Is there anything I should have asked you about but did not?
No, I think you hit all the points. I mean, we are looking to expand the team aggressively. So folks are wanting to get involved, feel free to reach out. That can include partners, obviously customers. If you're interested in the UbiGrow technology, you can go to the website. It is for sale online in small quantities, and we can work with you on if you've got kind of a larger project or a unique kind of greenhouse. And of course, investors, we're always looking to connect with like-minded sources of capital. And, you know, having completed our Series A in 2020, we look forward to the Series B sometime in the next year or so. And so, you know, any VCs in the audience would like to get involved, feel free to reach out. You can email me, hunter@ubiquity.com, or just find us online. And if you just want to be kind of an armchair enthusiast, you can just follow us on social media. We're pretty active there and see lots of cool pictures of glowing stuff.
Absolutely. And we'll include all those links into the show notes. Thank you, Hunter.
Thanks, James. This was fun.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the Google Play Store. I cannot express how appreciated it is, and we'll be back next week with another episode.